I remember the first meeting I had with the executive of my department when I became a minister. I said, I want you to draw up cabinet submission to get agreement to the terms of reference for the Productivity Commission. So it was a nice thing to start with for a paid parental leave scheme. And that was agreed by the cabinet, and then the Productivity Commission did an excellent piece of work. And
here it is.
The rest is history.
Here it is.
It's here, and now about 1 million parents have benefited.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. Now, my guest this week is Jenny Macklin. She's the Shadow Minister for Social Services, and people following the news closely will know that recently she told us that she's not going to contest the next election. As I think she's one of the most significant and influential figures in Labor politics in the last 20 years, I thought we would do an exit interview and consider how her career has impacted on how she's been able to achieve change. And also, I thought we might take a little stock take about the health of contemporary politics and what she thinks about that. So without further ado, let's get stuck in. Thanks for coming in, Jenny.
Thank you, Catherine.
So let's begin at the beginning, old-fashioned, I know. For a person like yourself, you're economically trained. Mm. That was your university qualification.
That's right.
So you could have had a number of different pathways. You're obviously a policy-focused person. You could have done a number of different things, but you chose politics. Why?
I was asked by Brian Howe in the early 1990s to do a review of Australia's health system, and it was really doing that big inquiry into the nature of our health system and how it could be improved, and seeing how he worked close up, getting big policy change, that I saw that the parliament and politics really could deliver improvements in a socially just way. And of course, he was the person in the Hawke and Keating governments who'd done so much for low-income families. And I really, I would say, learnt firsthand how to do it. But also that if you keep your focus very much on what you want to achieve, as Brian always did, just as an aside, I had dinner with him last Sunday and he said, you know, there's a lot more to do.
Yes, well, you would be admonished, I imagine, for leaving
exactly.
Your post.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, not so much that, but more, don't forget there's always more to do and you can't stop until you do it anymore. Mm. I think having him as a wonderful role model, and when he decided to leave the parliament, as it turned out, there was a big change. Of course, in 1996, a lot of ministers had been in the parliament and ministers for a long time in the Hawke and Keating years. They were leaving, and the opportunity to stand in Jagga Jagga came up. And I thought, now's the time for me to step from the backroom research role onto the front line.
So tell me about Brian Howe. I mean, I obviously remember him vividly, but perhaps not all listeners do. So what was it about Brian that gave you a role model for politics? Just describe that for us.
I think he's a very unusual combination. He was a Methodist minister of religion, very, very much committed to making sure that we introduced policies. Once he became a member of parliament in the late 70s and then through the Hawke years, made sure that Australia really became a more just place for the lowest income, most disadvantaged people. He also used a method that was really influential on me of policy development. And of course, he asked me to do one of those big reviews, but he'd also had Professor Bettina Cass and Meredith Edwards also do big inquiries, policy-based inquiries into the social security system, into the housing needs of Australians. And seeing the detailed research-based way he went about developing policy, and then the way in which he was able to work with the Treasurer at the time, Paul Keating. Obviously, he became the Deputy Prime Minister under Hawke and then Keating. He knew how to work both inside the Parliament and, of course, use his research and policy skills to great effect to bring about positive change.
And it's that sort of combination, I suppose, because your policy interests are similar, obviously.
Very similar, yeah.
And that fusing of the social agenda with the economic agenda, which was a great hallmark of the Hawke-Keating period, but is pretty important, I suppose, to not being marginalised within a government, even a progressive one.
Yes. And one of the great opportunities that Kim Beazley gave me when I first came into the Parliament was to go straight onto the front bench and to participate in, it wasn't called the Expenditure Review Committee, but the equivalent. And so I've really played that economic role, if you like, right through all of my time in the Parliament. And so what you learn from that is, of course, you have to figure out how to work with whoever the Treasury spokesperson is. And as I've said a number of times, probably the greatest combination, I think, that I was so fortunate to be able to form in government was to work so closely with Wayne Swan, someone who also understood the social security system. Not many people do.
No.
And also to have somebody who actually really, really cared about those people who do it tough in our society. So having the economic and the social together has been a great advantage.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get into your political style now that we've ascertained your sort of your pathway and your apprenticeship in politics and how you've been able to achieve various things. Let's think about style. Now, you don't court publicity.
True.
She's horrified standing here having this conversation, but she's doing quite well. You don't. You haven't sought to make yourself a commodity, which a lot of politicians do.
Mm-hmm.
Just has never been your thing. Do you think that's why you've achieved so much?
I do think that good policy takes time. This is especially so in government. Time is an unbelievably precious commodity. I've said this to some of our new people who I am sure will become cabinet ministers, that they cannot imagine how busy they will be if they are senior cabinet ministers and they're on the Expenditure Review Committee, for example, which I was for the whole time. So if you have these very big and senior roles, your time is unbelievably valuable and you do have to really think about how you're going to allocate your time. I think it's partly my nature. I'm really a bit on the shy side, so it wouldn't have been the first thing that I would have ever wanted to do, any interview. You do have to do, you know, a certain amount, obviously. Part of your job is to convince people that it's a good idea to have a paid parental leave scheme, for example. That was very controversial for about 10 years. So I had to convince people. You have to do that side of it. But being, as you put it, being a commodity yourself wasn't in my nature, really. And but I would also say you've got to think about how you use your time. It's a very, very big thing. Getting time to think, especially in government, is very tough, and you've got to really, really be focused on it to make sure that happens.
So it was sort of it was a deliberate decision that you've got a finite commodity, which is time, and a lot of pulls on it, for want of a better term. That's a conscious decision.
Partly my nature as well.
No,
so I'm not
sure.
I'm not saying it was all that and a conscious decision from that point of view, but it's a combination of those. Both of them.
Mm-hmm. And do you think your own style of politics, that more shut the door, get on with the work style of politics, is viable in the current look at me era?
I think the great thing is that the thing I love about the House of Representatives is that there's lots and lots of different types of people, and that's a wonderful thing about society, really, is that people bring all sorts of different personalities and backgrounds and experience, and so it should be to be the House of Representatives. And so I wouldn't say there's a right or wrong. I think you've got to be who you've got to be true to yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that's very, very important. And sort of going to something I know you're thinking about a lot, if you're not yourself, my experience is the Australian people are pretty good at
bullshit detectors,
picking that up. Exactly. Mm. And so it's always a good idea to be very true to yourself.
And let's just go back a little bit in your career, because I've made much of the fact that you're a recessed character in the way that you present yourself, and that's true. But you were, in fact, the Labor deputy leader to, get this, Simon Green, Mark Latham, gasp, and Kim Beazley, three very different characters. Mm. So, you know, you were in the more offensive position, I suppose, for a period of time with three different leaders through that long period of opposition. Mm. Then, of course, Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard showed up and rolled over the top of you.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, they're two quite separate things. So the period of being the deputy leader, I was the first woman to be a deputy leader in a major political party. So that was a big deal. And it was difficult for me, being a bit more of a backroom type person. You do have to step up and you do have to be prepared to do more of the public presentation side of things than might come naturally to me. But so, you know, that was a big step up. On the issue of Kevin and Julia, obviously it was very tough at the time, no two ways about that. But the thing that I felt really, really, once I got over the immediate upset, the thing that really convinced me to deal with it was I've seen a lot of people, not just politicians, but people who have a hard knock and then get very bitter. And I really didn't want to be that sort of person. And so I thought, well, if I am going to stay in politics, I have to just get over it. And if I want to be a minister in a government led by Kevin and Julia, then I have to get on with them. And so I...
So how did you go about that?
Well, part of it was talking about it in my own head, you know, coming to terms with it myself. But also I talked particularly to Julia about it.
Because that must have been particularly hard. Obviously, you and Julia, long period in the Victorian Labor Party together, would have known each other well, would have known an awful lot about one another. To have that experience must have been, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a Dr. Phil session, but that must have been shit.
It was difficult. There's no question about it. But I also had a lot of support. It wasn't as if, you know, I was on my own and everybody just thought, you know, get rid of her.
Bye-bye, Jenny.
People were incredibly supportive. And, you know, I had a lot of people who understood my situation and were very friendly. And so that side of it was good. But I thought, well, I have to resolve this. I have to go to her and talk to her about it. I did. Mm-hmm. And we resolved it. And of course, then
what did you say to her? What did you say to her?
I said, I'll work with you. I want to work with you.
And what did she say to you?
Thank you.
And it was that simple?
It was, in the end. That's what's so fantastic, I think. If you are prepared to deal with these issues rather than let them fester. I think she was surprised, to be honest, but it was a really good thing for both of us. She was generous and I think I was generous as well. And then I think we became a very effective partnership.
And then obviously rolled into that period in government after the sort of, you know, high points of the first couple of years, you rolled into that period in government and it all went to poop.
Well, it did from a...
I'm just talking about these characters. Yeah, yeah. We'll get into the policy of that period, but the dynamic between these two characters.
That's true. I have to say I really just got on with it. So, yes, it's true. Obviously, so much has been written and said about the two of them. I don't know that I've really got much to add, frankly, but both of them were very good to me, and I was able to do an enormous amount with both of them. So I am actually very grateful to both of them for enabling me to have the chance to deliver the big policies that I did. You cannot deliver these big things without a Prime Minister and a Treasurer who's going to support you. You wouldn't be able to do it. And so even though there were all those difficulties going on at a leadership level, and that's all true, it actually didn't stop me being able to work effectively with them individually.
And do you think possibly that was because it genuinely was a personality fight? Like, there wasn't a lot of policy difference between Julia and Kevin in terms of outlook. I mean, some, but that wasn't what it was about.
It wasn't what it was about.
And there was a sort of underlying consistency around the policy in that period. It wasn't a contest, as we see in the government, over ideology.
So take the biggest crisis was, of course, the global financial crisis. And those of us at the very senior level, I think, worked very, very effectively during that period from 2008-09 through to 2011, through this massive upheaval between the two of them. But nevertheless, we were delivering what Australia needed economically to keep people employed, which was certainly the focus that Kevin, Julia, Wayne and myself, the four of us who really had to drive that, we were very, very focused about what the purpose was.
Mm-hmm. And what do you feel stepping back, not that you have yet, but stepping back slightly?
Oh, yes, I have.
Well, no, but slightly. You are back from that period, at least. Mm. Looking at that period now, what do you think of it? Are you still traumatised by it? I think a number of people are, though.
I'm not, because, as I say, I actually just was able to get on with it, and they didn't try to
enjoin you into various things.
Well, in the sense of, which side I was on, obviously one is involved to that extent. But I was really able to get on with my job as a minister. So, and I had a huge portfolio. So
There was a bit to do.
There was a lot to do.
Yes, I recall. There was a bit to do. Let's get into the policy legacy now. So obviously paid parental leave, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, a million things.
Well, I think the paid parental leave is interesting from the point of view of this was very, very contested during the Howard years, and everybody's really forgotten. The attitude during that time was still, I think, a bit of a throwback to the 50s, that, mum would be at home and we had the baby bonus to support the new baby coming into the family, but it wasn't connected to the mother being at work. And I did an enormous amount of work inside the Labor Party with the trade unions, with employers. Some really great employers were doing good things at the time as well. And so we just had done a lot of that preparatory work really over about 10 years. So sometimes policies take a long time.
No, well, you said earlier on in the interview, and good policy takes time.
It does. It really does.
So, from that one, from go to woe, how
really... Even the 10 years before we even came into government, there'd been all this preparatory work, and of course different people had contributed along the way through the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. The Democrats had done some good work, as well as the ACTU, the employer groups, so there was a real widespread groundswell, but also a lot of detailed policy work. It wasn't just talking about it.
Feeling good about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we had made a commitment before the 2007 election to have a Productivity Commission inquiry. So actually I remember the first meeting I had with the executive of my department when I became a minister. I said, I want you to draw up cabinet submission to get agreement to the terms of reference for the Productivity Commission. So it was a nice thing to start with for a paid parental leave scheme. And that was agreed by the Cabinet, and then the Productivity Commission did an excellent piece of work. And
And
the
here
rest
it is.
Is history.
Here it is.
It's here, and now about a million parents have benefited. And a few years later, we introduced still a small dad and partner pay. And I think there's still so much more to be done to support dads.
Mm.
So many dads want to be much, much more involved than in the past. And I think that's just wonderful.
Mm. And the National Disability Insurance Scheme?
Well, that's the same, really, an even longer gestation. So it goes back to the Whitlam years. And there was a big inquiry done and reported right at the end of the Whitlam government. And, of course, the government was dismissed before anything could happen, and then it lay dormant for 40 years until Brian Howe and Bruce Bonihady came to see me and Bill Shorten, who was my parliamentary secretary for disabilities, and said to us, we need an insurance-based approach to supporting people with disability so that they can have strong and independent and productive lives rather than a welfare crisis-driven approach. And that took me really 5 years of detailed work. Once again, we went to the Productivity Commission to get them to do the detailed inquiry. But at the same time, there was fantastic work happening in the disability community. So they themselves did probably what I would consider the best on the ground campaign, the Every Australian Counts campaign, that just engaged so many Australians in the need to support people with disability. There was some really great technical work done by people outside the bureaucracy, you know, so there was a lot of external development of the idea. I think it was helpful that I was the minister all the way through. I think that's an important thing for a future government to think about. If you've got some big things you want to do, you can't be changing ministers every 10 minutes. Some of these things require a lot of detailed work. I would have taken it to the expenditure committee 4 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. It's a $22 billion scheme. Getting that sort of financial commitment, negotiating with the states, you know, doing all that technical work. The public service was just brilliant, from the head of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Treasury, Finance. You know, we had the best people in my department. So it was really an outstanding coming together of multiple forces in the community, the disability community particularly, and the best in the states, the best at the Commonwealth level. And as I said before, once again, you don't get this if you haven't got the Prime Minister and the Treasurer on board. And even though there was all sorts of leadership difficulties, it didn't stop this. This will be transformative for millions of Australians when you count the families that are affected as well.
There's problems with it though.
There are problems. Implementation of this shift is enormously difficult. We're moving from a charity model, block funded, to one which says the person with the disability is in charge, changing it from a state-based system. It's a massive change, and it's a massive change in so many ways. Yes, it's hard. And I suppose a really big thing I would say is I don't want people to be afraid of big reform just because implementation is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It actually means you've got to be determined and stick at it and deal with the problems as they arise. Big reform really, really is worth it when you see the change that it means for individuals' lives.
And you'd say it is still possible to do it.
Absolutely. I know there are problems, of course. People talk to me probably more than they talk to anyone else about helping them with their individual problems. We do a lot of that work. But I also talk to people whose lives have just been
transformed as well.
Mm.
How about the Northern Territory intervention? That was obviously a big, big deal.
It was a really, really big deal. And to this day, there's no question that the decision of the then Howard government to suspend the operation of the Racial Discrimination Act was wrong.
You supported it, though.
No, we didn't support the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act. But the Howard government, of course, had both the House and the Senate, so they were able to get whatever they wanted through. We did support the Northern Territory Emergency Response, but we did not support the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act. And as soon as I could, in fact, I reintroduced the operation of the Racial Discrimination Act. But to be fair, the damage had been done, to be fair to Aboriginal people. Mm. And as you would know, I spent an enormous amount of my time in the Northern Territory with Aboriginal people, trying to rebuild relationships, rebuild the trust that is so necessary if you're going to deliver the services and support that people need.
If you had your time again, would you do the same thing?
I probably would have tried to even redouble my efforts to try to deal with the hurt. It was very, very real. And the message that really was clear to me was, of course, the hurt that had been created because the discrimination was real that the Howard government had imposed on them. The thing that's interesting is the way in which this is reverberating through to today. In, as you might recall, we established an expert panel to look at constitutional recognition. And one of the big issues I know that was discussed by that panel repeatedly was how to make sure this couldn't happen again, how to make sure that sort of discriminatory action by a Conservative government couldn't happen. And that's why they made the recommendations that they did. And I think it's still reverberating through the Uluru statement that people want a voice and they want it in the constitution so that they have a constitutional right to their voice. So I can see the way in which this continues to reverberate through this very, very significant policy issue today. That's not to say that we weren't able to do some really good things. I was able to secure a huge amount of money for the services, the housing. We built more than 4,000 new houses and, you know, people's lives have been improved. But the message loud and clear from Aboriginal people is unless we're in charge, it's not going to work.
Mm.
And we need to say what needs to be done to deal with the reality. We know there is violence. We know, this is Aboriginal people, know that alcohol is an issue, but we're the people that will find the effective. We Aboriginal people are the ones that will find effective solutions. And it's not about working with. I think there's a bit of a phrase around about working with at the minute.
Rather than doing to.
Yes, that's right. And obviously with is better than doing to. But I read a fantastic article in the latest monthly by Megan Davis. And her point is, and I think this is really what the Aboriginal leadership is saying, is that it's more than that. We actually want to say what will work, and we Aboriginal people want you to
Back off. Let us do
what needs to be done.
And so where are you on the intervention? Mistake? Not.
Well, obviously it was a mistake because it was so offensive and it hurt so many people. And if, you know, I would never have done it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We would never have suspended the Racial Discrimination Act. That was wrong. It shouldn't have happened. You know, the government shouldn't have gone in over the top of Aboriginal people. That shouldn't have happened. And it wasn't effective as a result.
Mm. And so we've just got to think about things in broader terms now.
Well, we've got to actually make sure Aboriginal people are in charge and they're the ones that will say what the effective changes need to be to deal with what are very, very real issues.
Mm-hmm.
But they know that. Mm-hmm. They don't need us to tell them.
No, sure. Now, why are you leaving?
It really is time. Next year it'll be 23 years. It's a long time.
Does it feel like 23 years or does it feel longer?
Sometimes. And really that's it. It's not complicated. We have a new granddaughter and so that's an absolute delight. But it's also that I want to do some other things and I'm of an age where, you know, one can see that's not going to last forever. And also, I feel really great about the new people coming on. I think the next generation in our caucus is just fantastic. Mm.
Do you think they've got your detailed knowledge?
Maybe not the detailed knowledge. I mean, but that's not the point, really. It's more that they've more than got the capacity. You've got to step back to let people come through, and that was part of the decision to step to the backbench now, to let somebody else step in, and they'll bring their own skills and commitment. But we really, I think, have done a great job at renewal. There's a really, really, really talented group that will form the next cabinet at some point, whenever the Australian people decide.
Whenever that happens. Mm, yeah. And what about, what would be, I mean, I wouldn't express it as parting advice because it sounds a bit school mum-ish, but if you had to say what Labor should be in 2018 and beyond, what would you say?
Well, I've tried to say this to some of the real up-and-comers in the caucus, that yes, do your detailed policy work, but a lot of them are doing that anyway. They're really smart and hardworking, and they don't need me to tell them to do that. But another great book that I read recently was Gareth Evans' recent book, where he talked about his experience in different portfolios. So unlike me, he had quite different portfolios. I had the same one, basically. And so I also tried to say to my colleagues, you may not get the portfolio that you particularly want. You might be asked to do something that, and this is the nature of politics, you might be asked to do something that's really outside your comfort zone. And that's the nature of politics. And you've got to sort of rise to the occasion. The thing that really impressed me in Gareth's book, of course, he really wanted to be the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And then he became, after a few different portfolios, he became an extraordinary foreign minister, delivered so much as the foreign minister. He didn't go into politics thinking that that's what he would do. So I would say, look at that experience as well as mine or Wayne Swan's, where we stayed in the same portfolio. You can have a different ministerial experience and still
make a significant contribution.
Really good things.
And the party generally, where do you think it ought to be positioned? Obviously, there's been a debate through this period of opposition, quite a fascinating one. Not necessarily out there grabbing headlines, but quite interesting about whether, the balance between progressivism and laborism all of those different elements, right? So where do you think?
Well, as you know, I've been doing a lot of work since we've been in opposition on inequality, and inequality is growing in Australia, and insecurity is growing at work. There is less mobility in the sense that young people find it harder to afford a home, to get ahead in their job. These changes are deeply affecting, I think, the way in which people feel about government. Some of the big institutions like the banks and the churches have seriously let us down. I think we're seeing the horror of the abuse of children as a result of the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse. And we're also seeing the horrific results of the banks abusing families and businesses. So these big institutions that people have historically put so much faith in have let us down. And I think the thing that I'm thinking a lot about at the moment is, what does that mean for people's desire to have governments really come in and do the job that I think governments need to do? Nobody else can regulate the banks in the way that they should be. No one else sets the rules about mandatory reporting of child sexual abuse, just to use those two examples. And we've been through this phase over the last 30 years or so, post Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, this huge deregulation of the financial sector, get government out of your life. Well, the impact of that has been terrible for why did we have the global financial crisis? People need to pay their fair share of tax if we're to have the schools and hospitals and public transport and all the other things that you need. You need proper regulation to control the bad behaviour of banks and other financial institutions. So I do think that this is a big issue that hasn't been talked about enough. You can see there's quite a debate going on between the two sides of politics about fairness in the tax system, and I think that's a really great debate to have about if we want a more equal society, you've got to have a fair tax system. And so I'm very pleased with the work that's going on in that regard.
So Labor has to be the party of fairness.
Absolutely. That's who we are. And I just think the really detailed policy work that's been done by this opposition really demonstrates how committed they are.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice note to end on. So thank you so much for joining me, Jenny. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you to Hannah Izard, who has done production on the show this week. If you like the listening, don't forget to subscribe to the series via your favourite podcast app or iTunes or whatever that is. Take care, and we'll see you next time.